Welcome to The Learning Lunch. My name is Lumela Gyanki and I will be your host for today. Today we will be deep diving into social innovation and entrepreneurship with some of the most helpful lessons from the Bertha Center. Now, the Bertha Center educates students, entrepreneurs, and leaders in social innovation, social entrepreneurship, impact investing, and systems change. With us today, we have Kintse Khadebe, who recently joined us at the DG Murray Trust as our Innovation Director in the All Children on Track portfolio. Kintse has a keen interest in the broad study of social stratification, with a sharp focus on the role that institutions and organizations play in advancing or reducing inequality. She was actually previously the project manager for systems innovation at the Bertha Center herself, and we show that we have a lot to learn from her as NPO teams today. I really hope that you as the listener will use this as an opportunity to reflect on what today's conversation means for your own strategy and implementation in your teams. Welcome, Kintse. Thank you so much for being here today.
Hi, Lumela. It's wonderful to be here.
Can we start off with you telling us a bit about yourself? Who is Kintse? What led Kintse into being an instrument in driving social change?
Sure, this is such like a personal question, because I think it really just goes back to like my own upbringing and how I view the world. So I think as a child, I was always just curious about like certain things that were just happening around me. I think probably the one that I can call on the most, or where I had like a really vivid experience, was in my own education. So I grew up in the East Rand, in a small little township called Togaza. Okay, people might disagree in terms of how big or small it is. But what was interesting for me was that I would often have to leave Tolosa to go get what people thought of as good education in Model C schools. So I think from an early age, like, I was always struck by how different it was to, like, you know, be sitting in a taxi, be driving from Tolosa to, you know, Alberton, which was sort of like our where you could access Model C schools, and everything from just like how many trees there were to like the pavement, just everything was so different, and I didn't understand what that was. So I think as I moved through my own education, you know, high school, university, I was always interested in trying to answer that question, like, why do our societies look different? So different. What are the implications of that? And I was fortunate that when I was doing my social science degree at Wits, I was able to like grapple with, like, you know, gender, race, class, you know, all of those bits, and sort of then begin to paint a picture for myself. And I was always trying to then think about how does my work try to answer those questions and solve for those problems. Yeah,
I love that. Relatable also. Thank you. So can you tell us what exactly is this social and systems innovation? Like, can you describe it for us? Like, what does it mean?
Sure. I think a really simple way of thinking about it is to almost kind of leave terminology at the door. So I think for me, one of the things that I was always struck by whenever I was teaching a systems course or workshop was just people going, okay, this is a new term. We've never heard of it. Like, it's different.
It's the big words.
Yeah, it's the big words. And I think that often, you know, presents as like a barrier to learning something. But I think a really simple way of thinking about it is we all kind of understand what innovation is, right? So we know that maybe there's one way of doing things and we think that that's really great, but somebody else comes along and improves upon that, right? And specifically for social innovation, we're thinking about like instruments, interventions, programs that sort of change how society functions, whether that's across education, healthcare, entrepreneurship, all of these different spaces. Systems thinking, and really the crucial difference, is sort of broadening your scope of how you think about innovation. So going beyond just thinking about, am I solving for X, but what implications does that have for the wider ecosystem? So if I have an innovation that's particularly looking at, I don't know, reducing waiting times in a hospital, how does that speak to transport systems? How does that speak to small businesses in the area? How does that speak to schools that are, you know, feeding into that? So I think for me, when I think about systems thinking, it's to take that macro approach, to try and understand what are the relationships between the different players within the ecosystem? What are the power dynamics? So that when we're thinking about instituting change, we're not just thinking about our own silo, but we're thinking beyond that. Because systems thinking really encourages making those connections and understanding what the ripple effects are throughout the entire ecosystem.
I love that. Something else that I love is the conversation we had earlier where you said that social entrepreneurship kind of problematizes entrepreneurship, in a sense that everyone is looking at it as a solution right now.
Yeah.
A lot of young people especially are moving into entrepreneurship as a solution for the youth unemployment crisis that we're facing. Can you expand a bit on that? Like, what did you mean when you said that it kind of problematizes it? Because problematic is not the best word, but I really liked that you used that word because it made me think so differently about entrepreneurship.
No, absolutely. You know, it reminds me of a tweet that I actually saw this week about, I can't remember who it was, but it was a prominent political figure who was recommending that, you know, all young people should become entrepreneurs, right?
Imagine.
And of course, this is juxtaposed with the recent employment numbers that we've seen, like over 50% of young people in South Africa don't have jobs.
Exactly.
So it's a real crisis in our country, right? Mm. But when you think about a comment like that, you know, entrepreneurship is going to be the silver bullet for all of our challenges, it kind of ignores the context that the people are living in, right? Mm. So, first of all, I'm a big fan of entrepreneurs and entrepreneurship. Let me start by saying that.
We're not trying to say it's a bad thing.
Absolutely, absolutely. But when you think about some of the biggest social challenges that we have today in society, we really have to acknowledge that entrepreneurship isn't going to solve all
everything.
Of them, right? So I think for me, my current challenge is that by directing young people only to entrepreneurship, we're ignoring the other bigger pieces that actually need to be solved. So for example, I'm a big fan of government. And when I say I'm a big fan of government, I mean of building systems that work for people. Yes. We need amazing people in government to be championing the initiatives that we think are going to create like big frontiers for change for our country. Mm. The same thing applies to health, education, all of these different spaces. So we can't just be saying to people, become entrepreneurs without acknowledging that actually we need a variety of skill sets to solve our challenges. And I think for me, another challenge that I see when we center the narrative of entrepreneurship, that it kind of goes hand in hand with this narrative of like a heropreneur. So like this one person who's going to come up with this one solution that's going to change the world. And I think for the last couple of years, when we think about some of the most well-known entrepreneurs in the world, that's the narrative. All of it is about this one individual with a great idea. But the reality, especially when you apply a systems thinking lens, is that actually a lot of the big social innovations that we're looking for to create the kind of change we want to see require multiple players from different parts of the system working together, collaborating, really creating and opportunities to leverage the kind of social change that we want to see. Therefore, it doesn't make sense for somebody to center a Ginzi or a Hlumela in the story, but actually to think about who else needs to be sitting at the table. What voices are we actually not hearing? Where are the activists? We're civil society. Everybody is part of this choir. We don't just need one. Who are the main singers in a choir? Acapellas, whatever it is. We need like everybody, you know.
I really like that. That was a great way of explaining it. And it seems a bit self-centered to me when you say that entrepreneurship on its own is just a solution. I think it's important to have that thinking where you're looking beyond just solving the problem for yourself, as much as that is a great thing because it's opening doors and creating opportunities for your family and your employees. But also, what is it doing for the rest of the world? And also, like the example you used about the booming tech industry and how so many tech startups are rising. But what does that mean for communities that don't have network?
Absolutely.
So that's also something to consider. Gisa, can you just give us some examples of social enterprises that you think are doing really well in reducing inequality in our country that we can kind of learn from or look into?
Yeah, so I think there's many different examples, but I suppose if I had to pull one out of my own experience, I'd have to think of Degano. So Degano is a health equity fellowship funded by the Atlantic Institute based here in Cape Town that operates nationally. And the whole thesis of Degano is really amazing because even though the focus is on health and health outcomes, because we know that so many South Africans are reliant on the public sector, I think it's like 80% of South Africans access public sector healthcare services, but we know that the resources are actually not distributed equally. So I joined the fellowship, and this was a couple of years ago when I was doing a lot of work in the mental health advocacy space. What was really interesting for me was when I entered that space, I met people who are working as gender advocates. I met people who were working in rural areas, who were working in the public sector, entrepreneurs, artists, you know, poets, all of these people who had really different experiences. And what I loved about that, and I don't know if it was intentional in the organization's thinking, and I think it's quite critical a critical tenet of systems thinking is this idea that if you bring together different voices, the kinds of innovations or solutions or programs that you design fundamentally become different. Mm. And it influenced so much of my own thinking, because I think when I thought about the health system, I'd really only thought about the players that I know. Yes. I didn't think about those unusual suspects who are part of that community, who are part of influencing our health outcomes, whether it's somebody who, you know, is working in the transport services sector. Okay. And what does that look like? And I think for me, what's amazing about the work that they're doing is that when they bring together these fellows, the encouragement is work together, find ways where your projects intersect to actually create and design something new. So a lot of the grant funding that they offer to their fellows is actually based on this idea that you have to collaborate with others locally or internationally. So for me, it was amazing to meet other people who are working towards the NHI and thinking about, okay, well, how does mental health come into this? Or people who are working and thinking about, you know, LGBTQI access to for services. And I hadn't thought about that in my work. So now my work becomes richer and much more meaningful. And I think we can apply the same lens in all of our work, whether it's health, education, etc.
Cool. I think another thing with what you're saying, another thing that comes across a lot when you read into this, is these causal relationships that they talk about. Can you expand a bit more on what this term of causal relationships means?
Absolutely. And I think it's linked to what I was talking about earlier around being able to identify those connections in a system. Mm. And I think probably, for me, the greatest example of that is in one of our flagship projects here at DGMT, Grow Great, which is this campaign that is really looking at addressing nutritional stunting in young children. Nutritional stunting, we know, has adverse effects for young children. It affects them in their first early years of life up until they're entering school, and might even have implications for their ability to actually gain employment later on in life and be a productive citizen in our country. Mm. What's interesting about that is that when you're trying to solve for a problem like that, you might just think, okay, the only thing I need to think about is ensuring that mothers have access to food or nutritious food. Mm. But when you begin to have a systems lens to that, you need to then think about, well, what is the role of women in society? How are we thinking about supporting them? And what's been really fantastic about Grow Great and its partners, like Embrace, is that they're thinking about how do we ensure that women have access, for example, to a maternity support grant, so that women are empowered to be able to make choices around how they feed themselves as well as their children, right? But then it's part of a bigger conversation of, okay, if we know that the long-term effects of nutritional stunting might impact somebody's educational outcomes, what does that mean for our educational system? Mm. How should we be designing that differently? What intervention should we be leveraging in order to answer some of these questions? And then for people who are thinking about employment, and we know that this is a big issue in South Africa, if we're only solving for employment when young children are leaving, you know, grade 9 or grade 12 or, you know, higher learning and education opportunities, tertiary, then that means that actually we're only solving at the end of the line. Exactly. We're not actually thinking about it from the beginning. So if I'm sitting there as, you know, a policymaker or a funder, or I'm in government and I'm saying, okay, these are the solutions for, you know, youth unemployment, why isn't, you know, child nutrition part of that, right? So does that mean that, like, for example, the Department of Health should be having completely different conversations with those who are sitting sort of at the coalface of trying to solve this employment issue? Big questions, but I love that kind of thinking because it prompts us to think a little bit deeper and be really reflexive in how we think about interventions.
That's phenomenal. This actually reminds me of the earlier podcast that we did with Embrace, where we looked at the collective power of mothers as a movement in South Africa. And we looked at the first 1,000 days and how it's important to value the mother as a way of reducing inequality and not just see her as a gateway for the child, but also her own health affects the health of her child. How she feels, the food she gets when she's pregnant, affects how her child will perform and develop and grow when they're older. And those are things we don't consider a lot.
No, absolutely not. I think what's also amazing about Embrace is I feel like they really live this principle of doing work with humility, which is a big part of like systems thinking, is really being humble when you walk into a room, when you're engaging with people, when you're trying to understand an ecosystem. Because I think what's amazing about what the team does is that they have this really granular or even like ethnographic approach to trying trying to understand the experiences of mothers, of saying, actually, we're busy talking about, you know, birth, breastfeeding, belonging, but we're not talking about mothers, you know, in this conversation. What does that dyad between the mother and the child look like? Let's center those experiences. And I think for me, that is so powerful, because then that becomes really foundational and is a really authentic representation of the experiences of mothers.
That is so true. I love that. Okay, so Kinse, going back to your work at the Bertha Center, can you tell us a bit about the Bertha Center? You want to hear more about them. Like, what do they do and what was your role there?
Sure. So I joined the Bertha Center right at the beginning of 2020, so right before the pandemic. And it was such an amazing time to join, because so many institutions really had to shift their ways of working. And I think Bertha Center was one of those as well.
Definitely.
But one of the reasons why I wanted to join specifically the systems team is because of the kinds of questions that they were trying to answer, which was really thinking about how do we create transformative social change. And I think that's always been a core mission of my own life as well, and the work that I do. So what made for me Bertha Center really unique is that it sort of sits at this intersection of like social innovation and entrepreneurship, which is just really leaning on different ways of trying to understand the world. So what Bertha Center does is that it works across a number of areas: health, education, youth, the portfolio that I was looking at, systems innovation, as well as innovative finance. And really it's about bringing together people. So Bertha Center really focuses on convening, because we know that when we bring people together, something really special happens. And we were able to do that online and virtually during the pandemic. But I think that's like a really key and core tenet of, you know, Bertha's work. But then also really thinking about research, thinking about catalyzing communities, thinking about educating. So we, the Bertha Center had a number of executive education courses that really focused on from impact investing, systems thinking, as well as health, because it's really about thinking about what information isn't out there that we think is really important. What gaps do we need to fill for, whether it's the NGO sector or teachers who are like at the front line of being in a classroom. So that was really amazing. But also then investing in projects that we think actually can create the kind of catalytic change that will transform society. So for example, the Innovative Finance Portfolio really was doing amazing work in the impact investing space in terms of trying to leverage finance to create social change. So I learned a lot from being in that space and in that environment. And I think what's really great about Bertha Center is that it's located within a business school, but it's about thinking really differently about changing the world. So so really amazing work coming out of there.
Wow. It sounds amazing. I want us to go a bit into funding within the civil society space, specifically post-COVID. We're in the continent with the most number of NGOs in the world. We have an estimate of 200,000 NGOs in South Africa. And in 2015, there were over 140,000 registered NGOs. So that is quite a lot of NGOs. And I found that funding is a real challenge. It's a real challenge to maintain funding. It's a real challenge to keep in line with the strategy or the targets that investors have, and having to adapt yourself as an NGO to that. How can like your NGOs, especially your NGOs in smaller towns, kind of employ social entrepreneurship and systems thinking into their own work to kind of use it as a way of not being so dependent on investors or dependent on funders? Can this really work for every single NGO in South Africa? Do you think it's something that they can all use, or is it just specific ones that can employ this to kind of help with that funding crisis?
Sure. So this is going to sound like a cop-out, but this is a complex question that I think is really, really layered. And some of it might, exactly as you say, be context specific, depending on where you are, the sector that you're in. But I think for me, some of the key things that stand out, and a lot of it also just goes back to my own experience of having worked in the NGO sector and experienced what I experienced. And I think for me, when I started out in mental health, and this was what, 4 or 5 years ago, one of the things that I noticed was that there was so much replication, especially sort of like in urban areas that were densely populated. And it was really interesting to me how, because of that replication of services, there's oftentimes a lot of competition, and there's oftentimes a lot of anxiety around sharing information, which to me absolutely sounded absurd, because I was like, well, if you're doing this and I'm doing this, then surely we should be collaborating, right? But because of this idea that, well, I've got my own beneficiaries that I need to see to, that and outcomes that I need to report against, it really undermines this notion of community building within the sector. And I think a lot of people who are working in the NGO space will probably identify with this. And I think for me, one of the key aspects of systems thinking is this idea idea of being able to understand your ecosystem, the relationships, and to be able to make connections. But if you're constantly thinking of each other as competition or as rivals, then that really, it doesn't really facilitate that. So I think probably one of the best spaces to begin thinking about that, and I think where you'll find some of these answers, is within your own community, because those are the individuals who probably know the context best, who understand the landscape, who know what the gaps are. And can you imagine if you brought together, like specifically in my case, at the time I was thinking, well, if all of us are offering the same services, wouldn't it make more sense if we actually all came together and identified where the gaps were and then actually split that work? Like, wouldn't that have been much more effective? Wouldn't we have been able to provide much more comprehensive services across the board? So I think that's one way of thinking about it, but that takes a lot of work, a lot of relationship building. And I think, I don't want to discount any of the work that is already happening within civil society to say that this is an easy thing to do. But I think that's one way to be really doing transformative work that shifts you from a year-on-year focus to much more bigger strategic goals. The other part that I want to focus on is probably the bigger question, and that's the relationship with funders. And I think we absolutely, and again, cannot ignore the fact that this isn't an individual NGO issue. This is actually a bigger systems issue of how do funders decide how to fund? You know, what do they put on the table as like the requirements? Because oftentimes that becomes the determining factors that NGOs will follow. So I think a big part of that is actually shifting that dynamic as well. And that's why I think it's really amazing. There's an organization based in the UK, and I worked a lot with them when I was at the Bertha Center, and they have an amazing course for investors, you know, to try shift their perspective around how they think about how they invest. And I think we need similar kinds of initiatives for funders to say, actually, when you come together and you share information, let's be critical about how do we work. You know, let's challenge ourselves to think a little bit differently. And maybe because we do have power, and funders absolutely do, let's actually move the system towards the kinds of objectives that we're trying to reach. So can you imagine if a funder said, and it's amazing that more funders are thinking about this, but it's happening in a slow way. If a funder said, yes, we've got, you know, however X amount of money, we'd like, you know, to go towards solving this particular issue, but we want four or five organizations to work together to achieve that. Like, how differently will those organizations show up if they know that their success is also dependent on another partner's success? So that shifts the dynamic. But I think you need the kind of space to create that, and you need safety in creating opportunities to do that. And I think there's definitely room to do that within the NGO space, but it needs work.
I love that. So basically, if I'm getting correctly what you're saying that it's not something that can only apply to NPOs, but communities can look into systems thinking. Investors can look into systems thinking. Basically, everyone can employ the to kind of, you know, make our society a better place to live in.
No, absolutely. And that's why I think I started off by saying that sometimes the language is actually what's prohibitive, because so many organizations are actually already doing this.
Yes,
you know, so many organizations are already learning organizations, but we don't think about the work that they do in those terms, right? So many organizations are already collectivist, working within their communities, being embedded and really trying to understand the challenges that they're facing, but we don't frame their work that way. So I think when, especially when you're on the other side of being the researcher or the academic, there's a lot of power that comes with that, and you get sort of given the expert hat. But that just means that you're collecting information and sharing it in spaces where you perhaps have a little bit more legitimacy. But those who are also at the coalface and who are doing the work on the ground, who might not have the language or the ability to publish, you know, their work, are actually the ones who are curating that space. So I think it's really important for those of us who are sort of straddling both worlds to be able to ensure that there is a balance in how we share that information, right? And that in as much as there is the extractive element of, you know, research and gaining knowledge, that a lot of it is actually, there's a dyad, it's collaborative, and it's actually regenerative for NGOs themselves.
I love that. I really love how systems thinking kind of crosses the dimensions of time, and that it looks at the past. It looks at how did we get here, but then it also looks at the present. This is what we have to deal with now. But then it also looks at the future.
No, absolutely.
Yeah, which I think is really cool and something really different. Yeah.
That's actually a really nice way of putting it. I hadn't, you know, now I'm like, I'm thinking of all the frameworks. I'm like, yeah, we do have historical frameworks. Yeah.
That's awesome. Thank you so much, Kinte, for being with us today. That was such a fruitful conversation. I'm sure so many MPO teams have picked up a lot from that, have a lot to learn from that. Please stay tuned to the rest of the podcast, where we will be giving you the takeaway instructions for your exercise to do with your team. Thank you, Kinsey.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now over to you. Here are your takeaway instructions for this week. Firstly, you will need to visit the Learning Lunch webpage at www.learninglunch.dgmt.co.za. And this is where you will find the iceberg model of systems thinking, which will help you to complete this activity. Step 1. Select a facilitator who will walk your team through the process. Step 2. Place your team into groups. This activity can be done in one large group of 10 to 20 people or smaller groups of 3 to 10 people. The larger the group, the more time you may need to work on this activity. So just consider that. Step 3. If you are meeting virtually, find a way to capture the group responses on a digital whiteboard. You can use Mural, for example. Step 4. Think of this as a free thinking exercise. The point is to move relatively quickly through the activity. This should take you about 15 minutes. These are the questions you need to ask yourself. Think of a current event that strikes you as urgent, important, or interesting that's happening in your sector. Identify some of the trends, patterns that have been happening over time that have influenced or shaped this event. Think about whether there have been similar events over time. Identify structural factors that are driving the patterns that we're observing. Are there any laws, policies, rules, institutions, or physical factors that are influencing the patterns? Now think about the mental models, the attitudes, beliefs, morals, expectations, and values that reinforce the structures that we are seeing. Lastly, after completing the exercise, in your group, reflect on the following question. This should take your group another 15 minutes. At which level are you spending the majority of your time as a team or organization dealing with patterns, structures, or mental models? And how does this align with your mission?